all that matters. Start with the underpass. Save her from getting herself killed in the underpass. Before the morning, before she has even left her room, start there. He had been cracking up in the only way he knew how, which is not really cracking up at all, but sinking, all evening long being unmade by steadily sinking under the weight. A man who never goes full out and explodes, who only sinks. But now it was clear what to do. Go get her out of there before dawn. After dawn. After dawn, life was inconceivable. There was nothing he could do without Dawn, but she wanted Orcutt. That wasp blandness, she'd said, all but yawning to make a point. But that blandness had terrific glamour for a little Irish Catholic girl. The mother of Mary Lvov needs nothing less than William Orcutt III. The cuckolded husband understands, of course. He understands everything now. Who will get her back to the dream of where she always wanted to go? Mr. America. Teamed up with Orcutt, she'll be back on the track. Spring Lake, Atlantic City, now Mr. America. Rid of the stain of our child, the stain on her credentials, rid of the stain of the destruction of the store, she can begin to resume the uncontaminated life. But I was stopped at the general store, and she knows it. Knows that I am allowed in, no father. I'm of no use anymore. This is as far as she goes with me. He brought a chair around, sat himself down between his wife and his mother, and even as Dawn spoke, took her hand in his. There are 100 different ways to hold someone's hand. There are the ways you hold a child's hand, the ways you hold a friend's hand, the ways you hold an elderly parent's hand, the ways you hold the hands of the departing and of the dying and of the dead. He held Dawn's hand the way a man holds the hand of a woman he adores. With all that excitement passing into his grip, as though pressure on the palm of the hand affects a transference of souls, as though the interlinking of fingers symbolizes every intimacy. He held Dawn's hand as though he possessed no information about the condition of his life. But then he thought, she wants to be back with me too. But she can't because it's all too awful. What else can she do? She must think she's poison. She gave birth to a murderer. She has to put on a new crown. He should have listened to his father and never married her. He had defied him just that one time, but that was all it had taken. That did it. His father had said, there are hundreds and thousands of lovely Jewish girls, but you have to find her. You found one down in South Carolina, Dunleavy, and finally you saw the light and got rid of her. So now you come home and find Dwyer up here. Why, Seymour? The Swede couldn't say to him, the girl in South Carolina was beautiful, but not half as beautiful as Dawn. He could not say to him, the authority of beauty is a very irrational thing. He was 23 years old and could only say, I'm in love with her. In love? What does that mean? What is in love going to do for you when you have a child? How are you going to raise a child? As a Catholic? As a Jew? No, you're going to raise a child who won't be one thing or the other, all because you're in love. His father was right. That was what happened. They raised a child who was neither Catholic nor Jew, who instead was first a stutterer, then a killer, then a Jain. He had tried all his life never to do the wrong thing, and that was what he had done. All the wrongness that he had locked away in himself, that he had buried as deep as a man could bury it, had come out anyway because a girl was beautiful. The most serious thing in his life, seemingly from the time he was born, was to prevent the suffering of those he loved, to be kind to people, a kind person through and through. That was why he had brought Dawn to meet secretly with his father at the factory office, to try to resolve the religious impasse and avoid making either of them unhappy. The meeting had been suggested by his father, face to face between the girl, as Lulavov charitably referred to her around the Swede, and the ogre, as the girl called him. Dawn hadn't been afraid. To the Swede's astonishment, she agreed. I walked out on that runway in a bathing suit, didn't I? It wasn't easy, in case you didn't know. 25,000 people, it's not a very dignified feeling. In a bright white bathing suit and bright white high heels being looked at by 25,000 people. I appeared in a parade in a bathing suit in Camden, 4th of July. I had to. I hated that day. My father almost died, but I did it. I taped the back of that damn bathing suit to my skin seymour so it wouldn't ride up on me. Masking tape on my own behind. I felt like a freak. But I took the job of Miss New Jersey, and so I did the work. A very tiring job. Every town in the state, $50 an appearance. But if you work hard, the money adds up, so I did it. Working hard at something totally different that scared me to death, but I did it. The Christmas I broke the news to my parents about Miss Union County, you think that was fun? But I did it. And if I could do all that, I can do this, because this isn't being a silly girl on a float. This is my life, my entire future. This is for keeps. But you'll be there, won't you? I cannot go there by myself. You have to be there. She was so incredibly gutsy, there was no choice but to say, where else would I be? On the way down to the factory, he warned her not to mention rosary beads, or the cross, or heaven, and to stay away from Jesus as much as possible. If he asks if there are any crosses hanging in the house, say no. But that's a lie. I can't say no. Then say one. That's a lie. Donnie, it won't help anything if you say three. One is just the same as three. It gets your point over. Say it. For me, say one. We'll see. And you don't have to mention the other stuff. What other stuff? The Virgin Mary. That is not stuff. The statues, okay? Just forget it. If he asks, do you have any statues? Just tell him, no. Just tell him, we don't have statues, we don't have pictures, the one cross, and that's it. Religious ornaments, he explained. Statues like those in her dining room and her mother's bedroom. Pictures like those her mother had on the walls were sore subjects with his father. He wasn't defending his father's position. He was just explaining that the man had been brought up a certain way, and that's the way he was, and there was nothing anybody could do about it, so why stir him up? Opposing the father is no picnic, and not opposing the father is no picnic. That's what he was discovering. Anti-Semitism was another sore subject. Watch out what you say about Jews. Best to say nothing about Jews, and stay away from priests. Don't talk about priests. Don't tell him that story about your father and the priests when he was a caddy at the country club as a kid. Why would I ever tell him that? I don't know, but don't go near it. Why? I don't know. Just don't. But he knew why. Because if she told him that the first time her father realized priests had genitals was in the locker room when he used to caddy on weekends, that up until then he didn't even think they were anatomically sexual, his own father might very well be tempted to ask her, you know what they do with the foreskins of the little Jewish boys after the circumcision? And she would have to say, I don't know, Mr. Lvov. What do they do with the foreskins? And Mr. Lvov would reply, the joke was one of his favorites, they send them to Ireland. They wait till they got enough of them. They collect them all together. Then they send them to Ireland, and they make priests out of them. It was a conversation the Swede would never forget. And not so much because of what his father said. All that he'd expected. It was Dawn who made it an unforgettable exchange. Her truthfulness, how she had not seriously fudged about her parents or about anything that he knew was important to her, her courage, was what was unforgettable. She was more than a full foot shorter than her fiancé, and according to one of the judges who confided in Danny Dwyer after the pageant, had failed to be in the top 10 in Atlantic City only because without her high heels, she measured 5'2½". In a year when half a dozen other girls, equally talented and pretty, were positively statuesque. This petiteness, which may or may not have disqualified her from a serious shot at runner-up, it hardly explained to the Swede satisfaction why Miss Arizona should walk off winner of the whole shebang at only 5'3", had simply deepened the Swede's devotion to Dawn. In a youngster as innately beautiful as the Swede, and a handsome boy always making the extra effort not to be mistaken for the owner of his startling good looks, Dawn's being only 5'2" quickened in him a manly urge to shield and to shelter. Up until that drawn-out, draining negotiation between Dawn and his father, he'd had no idea he was in love with a girl as strong as this. He even wondered if he wanted to be in love with a girl as strong as this. Aside from the number of crosses in her house, the only other thing she lied about outright was the baptism, an issue on which she finally appeared to capitulate, but only after 3 solid hours of negotiations, during which it seemed to the Swede that, amazingly enough, his father had yielded on that issue almost right off the bat. Not until later did he realize that his father had deliberately let the negotiations string out until the 22-year-old girl was at the end of her strength and then, shifting by 180 degrees his position on baptism, wrapped up the deal, giving her only Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and the Easter bonnet. But after Mary was born, Dawn got the child baptized anyway. She could have performed the baptism herself or got her mother to do it, but she wanted the real thing. And so she got a priest and some godparents and took the baby to the church. And until Lou Lavov happened to come upon the baptismal certificate in a dresser in the unused back bedroom of the old Rimrock house, no one ever knew, only the Swede, whom Dawn told in the evening, after the freshly baptized baby had been put to bed cleansed of original sin and bound for heaven. By the time the baptismal certificate was unearthed, Mary was a family treasure 6 years old, and the uproar was short-lived. Though that didn't mean that the Swede's father could shake the conviction that what lay behind Mary's difficulties all along was the secret baptism. That and the Christmas tree and the Easter bonnet, enough for that poor kid never to know who she was. That and her grandma Dwyer, she didn't help either. 7 years after Mary was born, Dawn's father had the second heart attack, dropped dead while installing a furnace, and from then on, there was no dragging Grandma Dwyer out of St. Genevieve's. Every time she could get her hands on Mary, she spirited the child off to church, and God alone knew what they pumped into her there. The Swede, far more confident with his father about this, about everything really, than he'd been before becoming a father himself, would tell him, "Dad, Mary takes it all with a grain of salt. It's just Grandma to her and what Grandma does. Going to church with Dawn's mother doesn't mean a thing to Mary either way." But his father wasn't buying it. "She kneels, doesn't she? They're up there doing all that stuff, and Mary is kneeling, right?" "Well, sure, I guess so. Sure she kneels, but it doesn't mean anything to her." "Yeah? Well, it does to me. It means plenty." Lou Lavov backed off, that is with his son, from attributing Mary's screaming to the baptism. But alone with his wife, he wasn't so cautious. And when he was riled up about some Catholic crap the Dwyer woman had inflicted on his granddaughter, he wondered aloud if it wasn't the secret baptism that all along lay behind the screaming that scared the hell out of the whole family during Mary's first year. Perhaps everything bad that ever happened to Mary, not excluding the worst thing that happened to her, had originated then and there. She entered the world screaming, and the screaming did not stop. The child opened her mouth so wide to scream that she broke the tiny blood vessels in her cheeks. At first, the doctor figured it was colic. But when it went on for 3 months, another explanation was needed, and Dawn took her for all kinds of tests, to all kinds of doctors, and Mary never disappointed you. She screamed there, too. At one point, Dawn even had to wring some urine out of the diaper to take it to the doctor for a test. They had happy-go-lucky Myra as their housekeeper then, a large, cheery bartender's daughter from Morristown's Little Dublin, and though she would pick up Mary and nestle her in that pillowy, plentiful bosom of hers and coo at her as sweetly as though she were her own, if Mary was already off and screaming, Myra got results no better than Dawn's. There was nothing Dawn didn't try to outwit whatever mechanism triggered the screaming. When she took Mary with her to the supermarket, she made elaborate preparations beforehand as though to hypnotize the child into a state of calm. Just to go out shopping, she would give her a bath and a nap, put her in nice clean clothes, get her all set in the car, wheel her around the store in the shopping cart, and everything might be going fine. Until somebody came along and leaned over the cart and said, "Oh, what a cute baby." And that would be it. Inconsolable for the next 24 hours. At dinner time, Dawn would tell the Swede, "All that hard work for nothing? I'm going crazier and crazy. I'd stand on my head if it helped, but nothing helps." The home movie of Mary's first birthday showed everybody singing Happy Birthday and Mary, in her high chair, screaming. But only weeks later, for no apparent reason, the fury of the screaming began to ebb, then the frequency, and by the time she was 1 and a half, everything was wonderful and remained wonderful and went on being wonderful, until the stuttering. What had gone wrong for Mary was
was what her Jewish grandfather had known would go wrong from the morning of the meeting on Central Avenue. The suite had sat in a chair in the corner of the office, well out of the line of fire. Whenever Don said the name Jesus, he looked miserably through the glass at the 120 women working at the sewing machines on the floor. The rest of the time he looked at his feet. Lou Lvov sat iron-faced at his desk, not his favorite desk, out amid the clamorous activity of the making department, but at the desk he rarely ever used, tucked away for the sake of quiet within the glass enclosure. And Don didn't cry, didn't go to pieces, and lied really hardly at all, just held her ground throughout, all 62.5 inches of her. Dawn, whose only preparation for such a grilling was the Miss New Jersey pre-pageant interview heavily weighted in the scoring when she stood before 5 seated judges and answered questions about her biography, was sensational. Here's the opening of the inquisition that the Swede never forgot. What is your full name, Miss Dwyer? Mary Dawn Dwyer. Do you wear a cross around your neck, Mary Dawn? I have in high school. I did for a while. So, you think of yourself as a religious person? No, that isn't why I wore it. I wore it because I'd been to a retreat, and when I got home, I just started wearing a cross. It wasn't a huge religious symbol. It was just a sign, really, of having been to this weekend retreat where I made a lot of friends. It was much more that than a sign of being a devout Catholic. Any crosses in your house hanging up? Only one. Is your mother devout? Well, she goes to church. How often? Often, every Sunday without fail, and then there'll be times during Lent when they'll go every day. And what does she get out of it? Get out of it? I don't know if I understand. She gets comfort. There's a comfort about being in a church. When my grandmother died, she went to church a lot. When somebody dies or someone is sick, it helps give you some kind of comfort, something to do. You start saying your rosary for special intentions. Rosaries are the beads? Yes, sir. And your mother does that? Well, sure. I see. And your father's like that, too? Like what? Devout. Yes, yes, he is. Going to church makes him feel like a good man, that he's doing his duty. My father is very conventional in terms of morality. He grew up with a much more extremely Catholic upbringing than I did. He's a working man. He's a plumber, oil heating. In his view, the church is a big, powerful thing that makes you do what's right. He's someone who is very caught up in issues of right and wrong and being punished for doing wrong and the prohibitions against sex. I wouldn't disagree with that. I don't think you would. You and my father aren't that different when you come down to it. Except that he is Catholic. He's a devout Catholic, and I'm a Jew. That's no small difference. Well, maybe it's not such a big difference either. It is. Yes, sir. What about Jesus and Mary? What about them? What do you think about them? As individuals? I don't think in terms of them as individuals. I do remember being little and telling my mother that I loved her more than anybody else, and she told me that wasn't right. I had to love God more. God or Jesus? I think it was God. Maybe it was Jesus, but I didn't like it. I wanted to love her the most. Other than that, I can't remember any specific examples of Jesus as a person or an individual. The only time for me the people are real is when you do the Stations of the Cross on Good Friday and you follow Jesus up the hill to his crucifixion. That's the time when he becomes a real figure. And of course, Jesus in the manger. Jesus in the manger? What do you think about Jesus in the manger? What do I think about it? I like little baby Jesus in the manger. Why? Well, there's always something so pleasant and comforting about that scene, and important, this moment of humility. There's all that straw and little animals around all cuddled up. It's just a nice, warming scene. You never imagine it as cold and windy out there. There's always some candles. Everybody's just adoring this little baby. That's all? Everybody's just adoring this little baby? Yes, I don't see anything wrong with that. And what about Jews? Let's get down to brass tacks, Mary Dawn. What do your parents say about Jews? Well, I don't hear much about Jews at home. What do your parents say about Jews? I would like an answer. I think what's more remarkable than what I think you're getting at is that my mother might be aware that she doesn't like people for being Jewish, but she doesn't realize that there are people who might not like her for being Catholic. One thing I didn't like, I remember, was that on Hillside Road, one of my friends was Jewish, and I remember that I didn't like that I was going to go to heaven, and she wasn't.
Why wasn't she going to heaven?
If you weren't Christian, you weren't going to heaven. It seemed very sad to me that Charlotte Waxman wasn't going to be up in heaven with me.
What does your mother have against Jews, Mary Dawn?
Could you just call me Dawn, please?
What does your mother have against Jews, Dawn?
Well, it isn't that Jews are Jews. It's that you're non-Catholics. To my parents, you're just lumped with the Protestants.
What does your mother have against Jews? Answer me.
Well, the usual things you hear.
I don't hear them, Dawn. You're going to have to tell me.
Well, mostly about being pushy. And materialistic. The term Jewish lightning would be used.
Jewish light?
Jewish lightning.
What does that mean?
You don't know what Jewish lightning is?
Not yet.
When a fire is set for insurance purposes, there's lightning. You never heard that?
No, that's a new one on me.
You're shocked. I didn't mean to. Yes, I am shocked, all right. But we might as well get this out in the open, Dawn. That is what we're here for. It wouldn't be all Jews. It would be New York Jews.
What about New Jersey Jews?
Well, yes, I think they're probably a variant of New York Jews.
I see. To Jews in Utah, it doesn't apply, Jewish lightning.
Jews in Montana. Is that right? It doesn't apply to Jews in Montana.
I don't know.
And what about your father and Jews? Let's get it out in the open and spare everybody a lot of suffering later on. Mr. Lvov, even though those things are said, most of the time nothing is said. My family doesn't say very much about anything. Two or three times a year, we go out to a restaurant, my father and my mother, my younger brother and me, and I'm always surprised when I look around and see all the other families talking away amongst themselves. We just sit there and eat.
You are changing the subject.
I'm sorry, I don't mean this as a way to excuse it because I don't like it, but I'm only trying to say that it isn't even something they strongly feel. There's no real anger or hatred behind it. What I'm pointing out is that on rare occasions, he uses the word Jew in a derogatory fashion. It isn't really an issue one way or another, but every once in a while something will come up that is true.
And how would they feel about you marrying a Jew?
They feel about the same way you feel about your son marrying a Catholic. One of my cousins married a Jew. They might tease about it, but it wasn't a big scandal. She was a little older, so everybody was glad in a way she found somebody.
She was so old, even a Jew would do.
How old was she, 100? She was 30. But nobody was brought to tears. It's not a big deal until somebody wants to insult somebody.
And then?
Well, then you might want to get in a snide remark if you were angry at the person. I don't think the issue of marrying a Jew is a huge deal necessarily.
Until the issue of what to raise the kids is.
Well, yes. So, how would you resolve this issue with your parents?
I'd have to resolve the issue with myself.
What does that mean?
I would like my child baptized.
You would like that? You can be as liberal as you want, Mr. Lvov, but not when it comes to baptism.
What is baptism? What is so important about that?
Well, it's technically washing away original sin. But what it does, it gets the child into heaven if they die. Otherwise, if they die before they're baptized, they just go into limbo.
Well, we wouldn't want that. Let me ask you something else. Suppose I say, okay, you can baptize the child. What else would you want?
I guess when the time came, I'd want my children to make their first communion. There are the sacraments, you see.
So all you want is the baptism. So if the kid dies, it gets into heaven as far as you're concerned.
And the first communion. Explain to me what that is.
It's the first time we take the Eucharist.
And what is that?
This is my body. This is my blood.
This is about Jesus.
Yes. You don't know that?
You know, when everybody kneels, this is my body, eat of it, this is my blood, drink of it, and then you say, my Lord and my God, and eat the body of Christ.
I can't go that far. I'm sorry, I cannot go that far.
Well, as long as there's baptism, we'll worry about the rest later. Why don't we leave it up to the child when the time comes?
I'd rather not leave it up to a child, Dawn.
I'd rather make the decision myself. I don't want to leave it up to a child to decide to eat Jesus. I have the highest respect for whatever you do, but my grandchild is not going to eat Jesus. I'm sorry. That is out of the question. Here's what I'll do for you. I'll give you the baptism. That's all I can do for you. That's all. And I'll give you Christmas.
Easter?
Easter?
She wants Easter, Seymour. To me, you know what Easter is, Dawn, dear? Easter is a huge target for deliveries. Huge, huge pressures to get gloves in stock for people to buy their Easter outfits. I'll tell you a story. Every New Year's Eve, in the afternoon, we clean up all the orders for the year, send everybody home, and with my forelady and my foreman, I'd pop a bottle of champagne, and before we'd finish taking the first sip, we would get a call from a store down in Wilmington, in Delaware. A call from the buyer there for 100 dozen little white short leather gloves. For 20 years or more, we knew that call was going to come for the 100 dozen as we were toasting in the new year, and those were the gloves that were for Easter. That was your tradition.
It was, young lady. Now tell me, what is Easter anyway?
He rises.
Oh, Jesus.
Jesus rises.
Miss, you make it awfully hard for me. I thought that's when you have the parade.
We do have the parade.
Well, all right. I'll give you the parade. How's that?
We have ham on Easter.
You want a ham on Easter? You can have a ham on Easter. What else?
We go to church in an Easter bonnet.
And in a pair of good white gloves, I hope.
Yes.
You want to go to church on Easter and take my grandchild with you?
Yes. We'll be what my mother calls once-a-year Catholics.
Is that it?
Once a year?
Let's shake on that. Once a year, you got a deal.
Well, it would be twice a year, Easter and Christmas.
What are you going to do Christmas?
When the child's small, we can just go to the Mass where they sing all the Christmas carols. You have to be there when they sing all the Christmas carols, otherwise it's not worth it. You hear the Christmas carols on the radio, but in church, they won't give you the Christmas carols until Jesus is born.
I don't care about that. Those carols don't interest me one way or the other. How many days is this going to go on at Christmas?
Well, there's Christmas Eve, there's Midnight Mass. Midnight Mass is a high Mass.
I don't know what that means. I don't want to. I'll give you Christmas Eve, and I'll give you Christmas Day, and I'll give you Easter, but I am not giving you the stuff where they eat him.
Catechism. What about catechism? I can't give you that.
Do you know what it is?
I don't have to know what it is. That's as far as I go. I think this is a generous offer. My son will tell you. He knows me. I am meeting you more than halfway.
What is catechism?
Where you go to school and learn about Jesus.
Absolutely not. All right? Is it clear? Should we shake? Should we write this down? Can I trust you? Or should we write this down?
This is scaring me, Mr. Lavov.
You're scared?
Yes. I don't think I can fight this fight.
I admire you fighting this fight.
Mr. Lavov, we'll work it out later.
Later never works. We work it out now or never. We still want to talk about bar mitzvah lessons.
If it's a boy and he's going to be bar mitzvahed, then he has to be baptized. And then he can decide.
Decide what?
After he grows up, he can decide which he likes better.
No, he's not going to decide anything. You and I are going to decide right here.
But why don't we just wait and see?
We will not see.
I can't have this conversation anymore with your father. He's too tough. I can only lose. We can't negotiate like this, Seymour. I don't want a bar mitzvah.
You don't want a bar mitzvah?
With the Torah and all that?
That's right.
No.
No? Then I don't think we can reach an agreement.
Then we won't have any children. I love your son. We just won't have children.
And I'll never be a grandfather. Is that the deal?
You have another son.
No, no, that won't do. No hard feelings, but I think maybe everybody should just go their own way.
Can't we wait and see what happens? Mr. Lavov, it's all a lot of years away. Why can't we just let him or her decide what they want?
Absolutely not. I am not letting some child make these kinds of decisions.
How the hell can he decide? What does he know? We're adults. The child is not an adult.
Miss Dwyer, you are pretty as a picture. I congratulate you on how far you've come. Not every girl reaches your heights. Your parents must be very proud. I thank you for coming to my office. Thank you and goodbye.
No, I'm not leaving. I'm not going to go. I am not a picture, Mr. Lavov. I'm myself. I'm Mary Dawn Dwyer of Elizabeth, New Jersey. I'm 22 years old. I love your son, and that is why I'm here. I love Seymour.
I love him. Let's go on, please.
So the deal was cut. The youngsters were married. Mary was born and secretly baptized. And until Dawn's father died of the second heart attack in 1959, both families got together every year for Thanksgiving dinner up in Old Rimrock. And to everyone's surprise, except maybe Dawn's, Lou LaVov and Jim Dwyer would wind up spending the whole time swapping stories about what life had been like when they were boys. Two great memories meet, and it's futile to try to contain them. They're on to something even more serious than Judaism and Catholicism. They're on to Newark and Elizabeth, and all day long nobody can tear them apart. All immigrants down at the port, Jim Dwyer always began with the port. Worked at Singer's, that was the big one down there. There was the shipbuilding industry down there, too, of course, but everyone in Elizabeth worked at Singer's at one time or another. Some may be out on Newark Avenue at the Bury Biscuit Cookie Company, people either making sewing machines or making cookies, but most of it was at Singer's. See, right at the port, down at the end, right by the river. Biggest hire in the community, Dwyer said. Sure, all the immigrants, when they come over, could get a job at Singer's. That was the biggest thing around. That and Standard Oil. Standard Oil out in Linden. The Bayway section, right at the edge of what they called the Greater Elizabeth. The mayor? Joe Brophy, sure. He owned the coal company, and he was also the mayor of the city. Then Jim Kirk took over. Oh, sure, Mayor Haig. Quite a character. Ned, my brother-in-law can tell you all about Frank Haig. He's the Jersey City expert. If you voted the right way in that town, you had a job. All I know is the ballpark. Jersey City had a great ballpark. Roosevelt Stadium. Beautiful. And they never got Haig, as you know. Never put him away. Winds up with a place at the shore right next to Asbury Park. Beautiful place he has. The thing is, see, Elizabeth is a great sports town, but without having the great sports facilities. A baseball park, where you could charge 50 cents or something to get in. Never had that. We had open fields. We had Brophy Field. Matano Park, or Ananko Park. All public facilities, and still we had great teams and great players. Mickey McDermott pitched for St. Patrick's Elizabeth. Newcomb, the colored fella, an Elizabeth boy. Lives in Colonia now, but an Elizabeth boy pitched for Jefferson. Swimming in the Arthur Kill, that was it, sure. Close as I ever got to a vacation. Went twice a year to Asbury Park on the excursion. That was the vacation. Did my swimming in the Arthur Kill, underneath the Goethals Bridge. Bareback, you know. I'd come home with grease in my hair, and my mother would say, "You're swimming in the Arthur Kill again?" And I'd say, "Elizabeth River? You think I'm crazy?" And all the while my hair is sticking up greasy, you know. It was not quite so easy as this for the two mothers-in-law to find common ground and hit it off. For though Dorothy Dwyer could be a bit loquacious herself at Thanksgiving, just about as loquacious as she was nervous, her subject always was church. St. Patrick's. That was the original one down there at the port, and that was Jim's parish. The Germans started St. Michael's Parish, and the Polish had St. Adalbert's at 3rd Street and East Jersey Street, and St. Patrick's is right behind Jackson Park around the corner. St. Mary's is up in South Elizabeth in the West End section, and that's where my parents started. They had the milk business there on Murray Street. St. Patrick's, Sacred Heart in North Elizabeth, Blessed Sacrament, Immaculate Conception Church, all Irish, and St. Catherine's, that's up in Westminster. Well, it's on the city line. Actually, it's in Hillside, but the school across the street is in Elizabeth. And then our church, St. Genevieve's. St. Genevieve's, when it started, was a missionary church, you see, just a part of St. Catherine's, just a wooden church. It's a big, beautiful church now, but the building that stands now, and I remember when I first went into it. That was as trying as it ever got. Dorothy Dwyer prattling on about Elizabeth as though this were the Middle Ages, and beyond the fields tilled by the peasants, the only points of demarcation were the spires of the parish churches on the horizon. Dorothy Dwyer prattling on about St. Jen's and St. Patrick's and St. Catherine's, while Sylvia LaVov sat across from her too polite to do anything other than nod and smile, but her face as white as a sheet. Just sat there and endured it, and good manners got her through. So, all in all, it was never anywhere near as bad as everybody had been expecting. And it was never but once a year that they were brought together anyway. And that was on the neutral, de-religionized ground of Thanksgiving, when everybody gets to eat the same thing, nobody sneaking off to eat funny stuff, no kugel, no gefilte fish, no bitter herbs, just one colossal turkey for 250 million people, one colossal turkey feeds all. A moratorium on funny foods and funny ways
and religious exclusivity, a moratorium on the 3,000-year-old nostalgia of the Jews, a moratorium on Christ and the cross and the crucifixion for the Christians, when everyone in New Jersey and elsewhere can be more passive about their irrationalities than they are the rest of the year. A moratorium on all the grievances and resentments, and not only for the Dwyers and the LaBeouves, but for everyone in America who is suspicious of everyone else. It is the American pastoral par excellence, and it lasts 24 hours. It was wonderful. The presidential suite. Three bedrooms and a living room. That's what you got in those days for having been a Miss New Jersey. The U.S. line, I guess it wasn't booked, so we got on board and they just gave it to us. Dawn was telling the Salzmans about their trip abroad to look at the Simmentals in Switzerland. I'd never been to Europe before, and all the way over everybody was telling me, there's nothing like France. Just wait until we come into Le Havre in the morning and you smell France. You'll love it. So I waited, and early in the morning, Seymour was still in bed, and I knew he had docked. And so I raced on deck and I sniffed, Dawn said laughing, and it was just garlic and onions all over the place. She had raced out of the cabin with Mary while he was still in bed, but in the story she was on deck alone, astonished to find that France didn't smell like one big flower. The train to Paris, it was sublime. You see miles and miles of woods, but every tree is in line. They plant their forests in a line. We had a wonderful time, didn't we, darling? We did, said the Swede. We walked around with great big breadsticks sticking out of our pockets. They practically said, hey, look at us, a couple of rubes from New Jersey. We were probably just the kind of Americans they laugh at, but who cared? We walked around nibbling at the tops of them, looking at everything. The Louvre, the Garden of the Tuileries. It was just wonderful. We stayed at the Crillon, the greatest treat of the whole trip. I loved it. Then we got on the night train, the Orient Express to Zurich, and the porter didn't get us up on time. Remember, Seymour? Yes, he remembered. Mary wound up on the platform in her pajamas. It was absolutely horrendous. The train had already started up. I had to get all our things and throw them all out the window. You know, that's the way people get out of the train there, and we ran out half-dressed. They never woke us up. It was ghastly, Dawn said, again laughing happily at the recollection of the scene. There we were, Seymour and me and our suitcases, wearing our underwear. So anyway, for a moment she was laughing too hard to go on. We cut to Zurich, and we went to wonderful restaurants, smelled of delicious croissants and good pâtés and pâtisseries everywhere. Things like that. Oh, it was so good. All of the papers were on canes. They were hung up on racks, so you take your paper down and sit and have your breakfast, and it was wonderful. So from there, we took a car, and we went down to Zug, the center of the Simmentals, and then we went to Lucerne, which was beautiful, absolutely beautiful, and then we went to the Beau Rivage in Lausanne. Oh, remember the Beau Rivage? She asked her husband, her hand still firmly held in his. And he did remember it, never had forgotten it. Coincidentally enough, had himself been thinking of the Beau Rivage just that afternoon, on the drive back to Old Rimrock from Central Avenue. Mary at afternoon tea with the band playing before she'd been raped. She had danced with the head waiter, his 6-year-old child, before she killed 4 people. Mademoiselle Mary, on his own, on their last afternoon at the Beau Rivage, the Swede had gone down to the jewelry shop off the lobby, and while Mary and Dawn were out walking on the promenade to take a last look together at the boats on Lake Geneva and the Alps out across the way, he had bought Dawn a diamond necklace. He had a vision of her wearing the diamond necklace along with the crown she kept in a hat box at the top of her closet, the silver crown with the double row of rhinestones that she had worn as Miss New Jersey. Since he couldn't even get her to wear the crown to show to Mary, no, it's just too silly a thing, Dawn told him. To her, a mom, which is perfectly fine, he'd never get her to put it on with the new necklace. Knowing Dawn and her sense of herself as well as he did, he realized that even to cajole her into trying them on, the necklace and the crown together in the bedroom, just modeling them there for him alone would be impossible. She was never more stubborn about anything than about not being an ex-beauty queen. It's not a beauty pageant, she was already telling people back then who persisted in asking her about her year as Miss New Jersey. Most people involved with the pageant will fight with anyone who says they were in a beauty pageant, and I'm one of them. Your only prize for winning at any level is a scholarship. and yet it was with the crown in her hair. The crown, not of a scholarship winner, but of a beauty queen, that he had imagined her wearing that necklace when he caught sight of it in the window of the shop at the Beau Rivage. In one of their photograph albums, there was a series of pictures he used to like to look at back when they were first married, and even on occasion to show to people. They always made him so proud of her, these glossy photos taken in 1949-50, when she'd held down the 52-week-a-year job that the head man over at the Miss New Jersey Scholarship Pageant liked to describe as serving as the state's official hostess. The job of accommodating as many cities and towns and groups as possible for every kind of event, working like a dog, really, and receiving in compensation the $500 cash scholarship, a pageant trophy, and the $50 for each personal appearance. There was, of course, a picture of her at the Miss New Jersey coronation on the night of Saturday, May 21st, 1949. Dawn, in a strapless evening gown of silk, stiff and scalloped at the top, very tight to the waist, and below to the floor, a full, voluptuous skirt, thickly embroidered with flowers and sparkling with beads, and on her head, her crown. "You don't feel ridiculous in your evening gown wearing a crown," she told him. "But you definitely feel ridiculous in your clothes and your crown. Little girls always asking if you're a princess. People coming up and asking if the crown is diamonds. In just a suit and wearing that thing seem what you feel absolutely silly." But she hardly looked silly. Wearing her very simple tailored clothes and that crown, she looked stunning. There was a picture of her in a suit and her crown, and her Miss New Jersey sash, pinned at the waist with a brooch, at an agricultural fair with some farmers, another of her in her crown and the sash at a manufacturer's convention with some businessmen, and one of her in that strapless silk evening gown and her crown at the governor's Princeton mansion drum racket, dancing with the governor of New Jersey, Alfred E. Driscoll. Then there were the pictures of her at parades and ribbon cuttings and charity fundraisers around the state, pictures of her assisting at the crowning and local pageants, pictures of her opening the department stores and the auto showrooms. That's Donnie. The beefy guy owns the place. There were a couple of her visiting schools where, seated at the piano in the auditorium, she generally played the popularized Chopin Polonaise that she performed to become Miss New Jersey, leaving out clots and clots of black notes to get it in at 2.5 minutes so she wouldn't be disqualified by the stopwatch at the state level. And in all of those pictures, whatever clothes she might be wearing that were appropriate to the event, she would always have the crown set in her hair, making her look, as much to her husband as to the little girls who came up to ask, like a princess. More like a princess was supposed to look than any of the whole string of European princesses whose photographs he'd seen in life. Then, there were the pictures taken at Atlantic City, at the Miss America pageant in September, pictures of her in her swimsuit and in evening wear, which made him wonder how she ever could have lost. She told him, "When you're out on that runway, you can't imagine how ridiculous you feel in that swimsuit and your high heels. And you know that when you walk a ways, the back end is going to ride up and you can't reach behind you and pull it down." But she hadn't been ridiculous at all. He never looked at those swimsuit pictures that he didn't say aloud, "Oh, she was beautiful." And the crowd had been with her. At Atlantic City, most of the audience was naturally rooting for Miss New Jersey. But during the Parade of States, Dawn had received a spontaneous ovation that bespoke more than local pride. The pageant wasn't on TV back then. It was still for the folks jammed into Convention Hall. So afterward, when the Swede, who sat in the hall beside Dawn's brother, called to tell his parents that Dawn hadn't won, he could still say of her reception, without exaggerating, "She brought the house down." Certainly, of the five other former Miss New Jerseys at their wedding, none could compare to Dawn in any way. Together, they constituted a kind of sorority, these former Miss New Jerseys. And for a while there in the 50s, they all attended one another's weddings, so that he must have met up with at least 10 girls who had won the state crown, and probably twice as many who'd become friends of this or that bride during the days of rehearsal for the state competition. Girls who'd gone as far as being Miss Shore Resort, and Miss Central Coast, and Miss Columbus Day, and Miss Northern Lights. And there wasn't a one who could rival his wife in any category. Talent, intelligence, personality, poise. If he should ever happen to remark to someone that why Don hadn't become Miss America was something he would never understand, Don always begged him not to go around saying that because it gave the impression that her having not become Miss America was something she was embittered about when, in many ways, losing had been a relief. Just getting through without humiliating herself and her family had been a relief. Sure, after all the build-up the New Jersey people had given her, she was surprised and a little let down not to have made the Court of Honor, or even the Top 10. But that, too, might have been a blessing in disguise. And though losing would not be a relief for a competitor like him, not a blessing of any kind, he nonetheless admired Dawn's graciousness. Gracious was how the folks over at the pageant liked to describe all the girls who lost, even if he couldn't understand it. Losing allowed her, for one thing, to begin to restore the relations with her father that had nearly been ruined because of her persisting at something he so strongly disapproved of. "I don't care what they're giving away," Mr. Dwyer said when she tried to explain about the pageant scholarship money. "The whole damn thing," he told her, "is about being ogled. Those girls are there to be ogled. The more money they give for it, the worse it is. The answer is no." That Mr. Dwyer agreed finally to come down to Atlantic City had been due to the persuasive skills of Dawn's favorite aunt, Peg. Her mother's sister, the schoolteacher, who'd married rich Uncle Ned and taken Dawn as a kid to the hotel in Spring Lake. It would have made any father uncomfortable seeing his baby up there, Peg told her brother-in-law in that gentle, diplomatic way Dawn always admired and wanted to emulate. It brings certain images to mind that a father would just as soon not have associated with his daughter. "I'd feel that way if it were my daughter," she told him, "and I don't have what it is that fathers naturally feel for their daughters. It would bother me, of course it would. I would think that what you feel is the case with a lot of dads. They're very proud. Their buttons are popping and all that, but at the same time, oh my God, that's my baby up there. But Jim, this is so clean and beyond reproach. There's nothing to worry about. The trashy ones get sifted out early. They go on to work the truckers' conventions. These are just ordinary kids from small towns, decent, sweet girls whose fathers own the grocery store and don't belong to the country club. They get them up to look like debutantes, but there's nothing big in their backgrounds. They're just good kids who go home and settle down and marry the boy next door. And the judges are serious people. Jim, this is for Miss America. If it were compromising to the girls, they wouldn't allow it. It's an honor. Dawn wants you there to share in that honor. She will not be very happy if you're not there, Jimmy. She'll be crushed. Especially if you are the only father who isn't there. Peggy, it's beneath her. It's beneath all of us. I'm not going. So that's when she laid into him about his responsibility, not merely to Don, but to the nation. You wouldn't come when she won at the local level. You wouldn't come when she won at the state level. Are you now telling me that you're not going to come if she wins at the national level? If she is awarded Miss America and you're not there to walk up on the stage and hug your daughter with pride, what will they think? They'll think a great tradition, a part of the American heritage, and her father isn't here. Photographs of Miss America with her family, and her father isn't in one of them. Tell me, how's that going to go down the next day? And so he humbled himself and he did it, against his better judgment, consented to come for the big night to Atlantic City with the rest of Dawn's relatives, and it was a disaster. When Dawn saw him waiting there in his Sunday suit in the lobby with her mother, and her aunts, and her uncles, and her cousins, every last Dwyer in Union and Essex and Hudson counties, all she was allowed to do by her chaperone was to shake his hand. And he was fit to be tied. But that was a pageant rule. In case anybody who was watching might not know it was her father and see some kind of embrace and think something untoward was going on. It was all so that absolutely nothing smacked of impropriety. But Jim Dwyer, who had only recently recovered from the first heart attack, and so was on edge anyway, had misunderstood, thinking that now she was such a big shot, she had dared to rebuff her own dad, actually giving her father the cold shoulder, and in public, before the entire public. Of course, for the week that she was in Atlantic City under the watchful eye of the pageant, she had not been allowed to see the Swede at all, not in the company of her chaperone, not even in a public place. And so, until the very last night, he just stayed up in Newark and had to be content, like her family, to talk to her on the phone. But Dawn's sincerity in recounting to her father this hardship, of her being deprived for a whole week of the company of her Jewish beau, did not much impress him when, back in Elizabeth, she attempted to assuage his grudge at what he remembered for many years afterwards as the snub. That was just an old-world hotel. That was just the most wonderful place, Dawn was telling the Saltzmans. Huge place, glorious, right on the water, something you see in a movie. Big rooms, overlooking Lake Geneva. We love that.
I'm boring you, she suddenly said.
No, no, they replied in unison.
Sheila pretended to be listening intently to every word Dawn spoke. She had to be pretending. Not even she could have recovered so completely from the eruption in Dawn's study. If she had, well, it would be hard then to say what sort of woman she was. She was nothing like the one he had imagined. And that was not because she had been passing herself off with him as something else or somebody else, but because he had understood her no better than he was able to understand anyone. How to penetrate to the interior of people was some skill or capacity he did not possess. He just did not have the combination to that lock. Everybody who flashed the signs of goodness, he took to be good. Everybody who flashed the signs of loyalty, he took to be loyal. Everybody who flashed the signs of intelligence, he took to be intelligent. And so he had failed to see into his daughter, failed to see into his wife, failed to see into his one and only mistress, probably had never even begun to see into himself. What was he, stripped of all the signs he flashed? People were standing up everywhere shouting, "This is me, this is me." Every time you looked at them, they stood up and told you who they were, and the truth of it was that they had no more idea of who or what they were than he had. They believed their flashing signs, too. They ought to be standing up and shouting, "This isn't me. This isn't me." They would, if they had any decency. "This isn't me." Then you might know how to proceed through the flashing bullshit of this world. Sheila Saltzman may or may not have been listening to Dawn's every word, but Shelley Saltzman surely was. The kindly doctor wasn't merely acting like the kindly doctor, but appeared to have fallen somewhat under Dawn's spell, the spell of that alluring surface whose underside, as she presented it to people, was as charmingly straightforward as it could be. Yes. After all she'd been through, she looked and she behaved as though nothing had happened. For him, there was this two-sidedness to everything, side by side the way it had been and the way it was now. But Dawn made it sound as though the way it had been was still the way it was. After the tragic detour their lives had taken, she managed in the last year to arrive back at being herself, apparently just by not thinking about certain things, and arrive back not merely at Dawn, with her facelift and her petite gallantry and her breakdowns and her cattle and her decisions to change her life, but back at the Dawn of Hillside Road, Elizabeth, New Jersey. A gate, some sort of psychological gate, had been installed in her brain, a mighty gate past which nothing harmful could travel. She locked the gate, and that was that. Miraculous, or so he thought, until he learned that the gate had a name. The William Orcutt III Gate. Yes, if you missed her back in the 40s, here once again was Mary Dawn Dwyer of Elizabeth's Elmora section, an up-and-coming Irish looker from a working-class family that was starting to do okay, respectable parishioners at St. Genevieve's, the classiest Catholic church in town, miles uptown from the church by the docks, where her father and his brothers had been altar boys. Once again, she was in possession of that power she had even as a 20-year-old, to stir up interest in whatever she said, somehow to touch you inwardly, which was not often true of the contestants who won at Atlantic City. But she could do that, lay bare something juvenile, even in adults, by nothing more than venting ordinary, lively enthusiasms through that flagrantly perfect, strikingly executed, heart-shaped face. Maybe, until she spoke and revealed her attitudes as not so different from any decent person's, people were frightened of her for looking like that. Discovering that she was not at all a goddess, had no interest in pretending to be one, discovering in her almost an excess
of no pretense, made even more riveting the brilliant darkness of her hair, the angular mask not much bigger than a cat's, and the eyes, the big, pale eyes, almost alarmingly keen and vulnerable. From the message in those eyes, one would never have believed that this girl was going to grow up to be a shrewd businesswoman, resolutely determined about turning a profit as a cattle breeder. What excited the Swede's tenderness always was that she, who wasn't at all frail, nonetheless looked so delicate and frail. This always impressed him, how strong she was, once was, and how vulnerable her kind of beauty caused her to appear, even to him, her husband, long after one might imagine that married life had dulled the infatuation. And how plain Sheila looked sitting alongside her, purportedly listening to her, plain and proper, sensible, dignified, and dreary. So dreary. Everything in her severely withheld, hidden. There was nothing hearty in Sheila. There was lots in Dawn. There once was in him. That once described everything there was in him. It was not easy to understand how he could have ever found in this prim, severe, hidden, whatever she was, a woman more magnetic than Dawn. How pathetic he must have been. How depleted, a broken, helpless creature, escaping from everything that had collapsed, running in the headlong way that someone in trouble will take flight in order to make a bad thing worse. Almost all there was to attract him was that Sheila was someone else. Her clarity, her candor, her equilibrium, a perfect self-control were at first almost beside the point. Shrinking from such a blinding catastrophe, disconnected as he'd never been before from his ready-made life, notorious and disgraced as he'd never been before, he turned in a daze to the one woman other than his wife whom he knew even remotely in a personal way. That was how he got there, seeking asylum, hounded. The forlorn reason for a straight arrow so assertively uxorious, so intensely and spotlessly monogamous, hurling himself at such an extraordinary moment into a situation he would have thought he hated, the shameful fiasco of being untrue. But amorousness had little to do with his clutching. He could not offer the passionate love that Dawn drew from him. Lust was far too natural a task for someone suddenly so misshapen, the father of someone gruesomely misbegotten. He was there for the illusion. He lay atop Sheila like a person taking cover, digging in, a big male body in hiding, a man disappearing. Because she was somebody else, maybe he could be somebody else too. But that she was someone else was what made it all wrong. Alongside Dawn, Sheila was a well-groomed, impersonal thinking machine, a human needle threaded with a brain nobody he could want to touch, let alone sleep with. Dawn was the woman who had inspired the feat for which even his record-breaking athletic career had barely fortified him, vaulting his father. The feat of standing up to his father, and how she had inspired it was by looking as spectacular as she looked and yet talking like everyone else. Was it bigger, more important, worthier things that inclined others to a lifelong mate? Or at the heart of everyone's marriage, was there something irrational and unworthy and odd? Sheila would know. She knew it all. Yes, she'd have the answer to that one, too. She'd come so far, Sheila had said. She'd gone so much stronger. I thought that she could make it on her own. She's a strong girl, Seymour. She's a crazy girl. She's crazy. She's troubled. And the father plays no role with the troubled daughter? I'm sure he played plenty of a role. I just thought something terrible had happened at home. Oh, he wanted his wife back. It was impossible to exaggerate the extent to which he wanted her back. The wife so serious about being a serious mother. The woman so fiercely disinclined to be thought spoiled, or vain, or frivolously nostalgic for her once glamorous eminence, that she would not wear, even as a joke for her family, the crown and the hat box at the top of her closet. His endurance had run out. He wanted that Dawn back right Now, what were the farms like, Sheila asked her. In Zug, you were going to tell us about the farms. This interest of Sheila's in figuring it all out. How could he have wanted anything to do with her?